This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Diageo's is on the move. Its Bloomington location is headed east next to the company's first Mexican Tex-Mex restaurant. Could it be the start of another chain?
If there's opportunities out there for us to grow this concept the way that we've grown Biagi's, we're certainly prepared to do that.
Biagi's CEO Todd Hovenden talks to GLT's Eric Stock. There's a third Illinois House race here in McLean County, and you'll meet the Republican who wants the job. And we're debating the merits of Illinois' favorite furry backyard friend, the squirrel. After a GLT news update, this is Sound Ideas on GLT. Thanks for choosing this GLT podcast. While it's free to you, it's not free to produce. Take a moment and make a contribution to help pay for this program. Go to WGLT.org, and thanks. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. The two Illinois House districts that cover Bloomington Normal are getting lots of attention this election year. It's the first time incumbent Republicans Dan Brady and Keith Sommer have faced general election opponents in years. But there's a third House district in McLean County, too, and there's no incumbent protecting it. It's the 101st House district, and it includes communities like Hayworth, Leroy, Downs, Arrowsmith, and Saybrook. State Representative Bill Mitchell is not seeking re-election in that district, opening it up for a race between Republican Dan Calkins and Democrat Jen McMillan, both from Decatur. Calkins is a former Decatur City Council member who now serves on the Eastern Illinois University Board of Trustees. He owned his own assisted living company until selling it 2 years ago. He told me his key issue is fiscal restraint.
I saw the issues that were going on in Springfield and the discord, the inability to find some common grounds. Maybe a little adult leadership was necessary. So, I felt like I should offer myself up.
This is not your first foray into public office. You served on the Decatur City Council, as you mentioned, from 2005 to 2009, and are now on the Eastern Illinois University Board of Trustees. So what do you take away from those experiences, working in a public body with other human beings, that you think would be instructive should you get the job and go to Springfield?
Interesting, other human beings, yes. Sometimes we think about Springfield and we're not so sure what goes on over there. But my experience as a city councilman gave me an opportunity to learn to work, and I've worked on several nonprofit boards, United Way boards and such, and committees. But to work in the public eye, to have a group of people that are dedicated to making the city of Decatur a better place, and then it came down to setting priorities and being able to work with people in priorities. You know, one of the things that I did I'm most proud of on the city councils, we had a health care plan for our employees that was outrageously expensive. And I made it a mission of mine to get that health care plan put out for bid and in a open setting, fair to all comers. Kicking and screaming, I drug the administration through that process. And in the end, we saved our city taxpayers over a million, $1.2 million in the first couple of years. So that was one way for me to help and give back. And I think it sets a kind of a tone, that I don't just go along with whatever, the city manager is going to tell me. And I was able to persuade enough of my fellow council members that we needed to do it. Eastern Illinois University. I've been a trustee for a little over 3 years now. When I went down there, things were in pretty bad shape, really. I thought for sure that Governor Rauner had sent me down there to turn the lights out. I mean, they had gone through all of their cash reserves. They were looking at not being able to make summer payroll and, in the next summer. And enrollment had declined significantly, like 3,000 students. And able to work with the other board members and, of course, with President Glassman, and we were able to come together and come up with a solution that we felt would save Eastern Illinois University. Wasn't easy, but we cut $40 million out of our budget in 2 years. We have completely revamped the university. We've revitalized all of our offerings. We're now we now have, I'm sure you have noticed, that we've had a considerable uptake in our freshman class this fall, to a 25% increase, almost 25% increase. I think that, those two experiences have given me a good broad foundation to take to Springfield to build coalitions and to help solve this economic disaster that seems to engulf us.
So what would be your top issues should you become elected?
The very first issue is nonpartisan, and I say that because I'm looking forward to Springfield next January. There are going to be 25 brand new state representatives come to Springfield to be sworn in January. I'd like to, and I've already kind of started on this project, but I think that if we can get that group together, a freshman class together, and we can agree as a group that we're not going to spend any more money than we take in. None of this phony budget, none of this selling the Thompson Building for $300 million a year last year, this year, who knows next year, to try to have a balanced budget that's not balanced, and they pretended it's a balanced budget.
A key issue in the race for governor, at least, has been this idea of a progressive or graduated income tax. Mm-hmm. This has been proposed by Democrat J.B. Pritzker, opposed by his Republican opponent, Bruce Rauner. You know, essentially moving the state of Illinois away from a flat income tax level to a graduated progressive. The rates are different depending on what your income is. What do you think of this idea?
I think it's a terrible idea. I mean, that's the short answer. This scheme, this changing the tax scheme, was proposed a couple of years ago in the House. It was scored. And at that time, the parameters that were presented showed that we would lose about 70,000 jobs. People would leave. It makes us even less competitive. Let's just start with this progressive tax, and it's always, you know, sounds good. Tax the rich, tax the rich, tax the rich. You can't tax your way into prosperity. There is never in the history of the world a government has taxed itself into prosperity. The first component is we have to get our spending under control. They always start out, oh, we're only going to tax these people up here. If you only make, you know, it's only going to increase your taxes if you make over 65 or 75,000. What happens is that the people that are making $75,000, $100,000, they either figure out how not to make that or they leave. And then the government goes, oh, well, wait a minute, we're not getting the money we want. Let's drop that down to $35,000. And a year or two later, oh, we're not getting the revenue we need. Let's drop that down to $25,000. And the next thing you know, everybody in the state of Illinois is going to be paying more in income taxes than they are today.
This is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm here with Dan Calkins, a Republican candidate for state representative in the 101st House District. The district includes parts of McLean County, communities like Hayworth, Leroy, Downs, Arrowsmith, and Saybrook. The bulk of the population of that district, though, is in Macon County. He'll face Democrat Jen McMillan in November. Dan, let's stick with taxation. You've said that we need to make government bodies less dependent on property taxes. How do you do that while still making sure that the schools, cities, libraries, those that rely so heavily on property taxes are still adequately funded?
You make them more efficient, first of all. You give them an opportunity. You give them the ability to become more efficient. You take care. You take out layers of administration. You combine you're able to combine the regional districts, the superintendent's offices. Do you need a superintendent of schools over a high school and a grade school and a middle school? And now you have a superintendent of school. You have principals in all those buildings and a superintendent and a secretary and maybe another staff person over those three buildings. We need to look at ways to economize. You know, all is good when money is plentiful and you can spend money because there's more than you can, you know, than you need. But now in Illinois, we are in a situation where we have to find ways to economize. We have to do more, be more efficient with less money. And I think One of the, and I said this years ago when I ran for city council, you bring this back. The only way to shrink government is to starve it. If you give a government body less money, they'll figure it out.
So the starve the beast sort of philosophy.
Yeah. It is. I mean, you know, they get a reload every year, more money every year, and so they just, you know, a government body will go along and not have to worry about becoming efficient. I think that if you give that incentive and go, look, this is all you're getting. This is it. Figure it out.
So you kind of went through this with Eastern Illinois University.
Indeed.
You've been a trustee for almost 3 years there.
Right.
They sort of lived through a starve the beast moment where they got dramatically less money and dealt with it. I mean, is that a good experience
for
them?
It. Absolutely it is. And now with our increased – what that's done – it's enthused our administration, it's enthused our faculty, it's enthused our students, and it's enthused the community to work hard to come together and to promote that school, to be responsive to our faculty, to be responsive to the students, and for our administration to be responsive to incoming students, which now has driven up our enrollment. Well, as enrollment grows, guess what happens? Our income grows. And as our income grows, we can now afford to do things that we couldn't before. So it's earn the money. Don't just keep throwing money after money after money. Let's get lean. Let's get down to where we can work and be very efficient and grow our economy from there.
You're going to be on the ballot here in November alongside Governor Bruce Rauner. So what did you think of his first term in office?
I supported Governor Rauner 4 years ago when he first ran. I thought that he was the best candidate, and he pulled out a victory. I have agreed with him on several things, and I've disagreed with him on some issues. And when I've agreed with him, I've helped promote those issues. And when I've disagreed with him, HB 40 being one of them.
That's the abortion measure?
Right. I've spoken to him directly about it, and I've made it very clear that we disagree, and that's the role of a legislature. I mean, if I'm fortunate enough to get to Springfield, we're going to have a governor. Now, I would prefer it to be Governor Rauner reelected, but I'll work with the governor when we agree on issues. When there's things that we can do that'll make Illinois better, that'll benefit the people of the 101st, I'll work with that governor. And when there are issues that come up that I disagree with them about, I will oppose that governor. And that's just the long and short of it.
Well, if he were to become reelected and you and he are in Springfield together, how would you want to see him change his approach in his second term to be more effective?
Well, I think you've heard that in his press conference in Springfield. I think he's learned a lot in 4 years. I know my 4 years on the city council, I learned a lot. I was a little strong-headed, and when I first got elected, and I had to learn to work with the other people on the council and the mayor and city manager. And I think Governor Rauner has learned a lesson. He's proclaimed that. He's done a lot of good things. I mean, he's worked in the criminal justice system, reforms. He's done things that he hasn't gotten credit for, I think because the media has been so negative.
If Governor Rauner were to lose the election to presumably Democrat to J.B. Pritzker, what steps would you take to still be a productive member of the General Assembly, even if the Republicans did not hold the governor's office?
Well, I think that's going to be a challenge, but it's a challenge now. I mean, the Republicans are in the supermajority in the Senate, and they're in a minority in the House, and I'm not sure that we're going to flip the House. We have to flip 9 seats, and even though we flipped 5 seats 2 years ago, I don't anticipate 9 seats being, you know, changing hands in November. But it will require a steady I think reasoned adult conversations to be had amongst my constituents, in Springfield, the whole group. You know, they do work on things, and there are bipartisan efforts in spite of what you want to hear or read. And I think there are opportunities. I hope so. I believe that this to be the case, that there are going to be opportunities where both sides can come together and have a reasonable discussion and work on solutions that are best for Illinois. We need to find a way to quit spending money we don't have. We need to find a way to attract businesses and keep people and bring people back to Illinois in order to grow our economy, in order to grow this state, to get it back to where it was. And the thing that I'm kind of curious about, really, if you want money for social programs, that money has to come from somewhere. And we have taxed our citizens to the max already. So how do you get more money in Illinois? How do you collect more money in state government? You grow the economy. We need to look at Indiana and Wisconsin and Iowa and Missouri and Kentucky. How have they done it? What have they done? Let's emulate some of the things that our sister states have done all around us, and their economies are doing very, very well. And let's adopt some of those things and bring them back to Illinois. And let's grow our economy. Let's make this place prosperous again.
That's Dan Calkins, who will face Democrat Jen McMillan on November 6th in the 101st House District. You'll hear an interview with McMillan on Monday on Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from the BCPA, presenting Who's Live Anyway, a completely improvised 90-minute show of games, scenes, and songs to tickle your funny bone. Audience members might have the chance to join the cast on stage Wednesday, October 17th at 7:30. Tickets at artsblooming.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Lots of teens struggle with their electronics, their emotions, and their peers. Tricia Malott of the McLean County Behavioral Health Coordinating Council says Monday's Behavioral Health Forum in Normal might be able to help. She says organizers hope to engage adolescents, particularly those who are struggling with issues related to social media, like cyberbullying, anxiety, and depression.
So while we still have a day of breakout sessions for adults, we have also created a day where youth can come and attend sessions and learn about mindfulness, bullying, some techniques for addressing behavioral health, in addition to also hear from some of their peers. And we also have the direct tie-in to our keynote from Dr. Flores.
Dr. Susanna Flores, who is a former Chicago resident and now an Arizona-based clinical psychologist, writer, and public speaker, and she is joining us now on the line from Arizona. She's the author of Facehooked, How Facebook Affects Our Emotions, Relationships, and Lives. Dr. Flores, welcome.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Give me an idea of what your message will be to the crowd here, mostly young people who will be there to hear your message.
Well, you know, my book, Facehooked, is not a get-off-of-social media book. It's one about awareness in terms of how we are, the way that we are expressing ourselves and interpreting information has been changing since the dawn of Facebook and other social media platforms, because we're receiving information in a different way. And so it's more about just being aware about how we are expressing our authenticity, how our friendships are changing, how our view of privacy has drastically changed, and be touching on cyberbullying and the polarization even of America based on social media interactions. And also, of course, the addictive quality of social media.
And how has it impacted mental health and behavioral health of young people? Mm-hmm. And have you seen it make a difference?
Absolutely. Psychologists are seeing record number anxiety reports and depression reports, mostly due to, you know, the expression and interpretation of information, especially lately, you know, with everything going on in the news. And what's happening is, you know, as an example, is we're receiving multiple messages from multiple sources throughout multiple times during the day. And even psychologically, I'm not sure that we're able to, or we were designed to interpret information this way. And so, you know, we're only receiving information through like 140 characters on Twitter, for example, and we're making interpretation and assumptions based on that. So the way that we are treating ourselves and the way we are treating others has systematically shifted, which is leading to these symptoms. symptoms.
What does the effects of overuse of social media have on causing behavioral problems? Because you mentioned there's an addictive nature to it. Or does it simply shine light and amplify that problem?
There's a lot of research that shows that we're actually getting dopamine hits every time we're getting a push notification or a like, which is why many times we're editing ourselves in a way to promote these likes. Whether we realize it or not, we're doing it subconsciously. So like if you type something and you press delete, 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 you know, and you're trying to craft it in a way to seek external approval. And so, you know, teenagers call the addictive quality like, you know, FOMO, fear of missing out. And so there's this notion of, it's kind of like a slot machine effect. It's, intermittent reinforcement. There might be something interesting, there might not be something interesting, but you better check it, right? Which is why many of us are treating our smartphones, the mobile device, which makes it so, which adds to the addictive quality of it because we're always wired in. The smartphone has become almost an extension of our arm. It's always within arm's reach. And so in many ways, social media is controlling us versus the other way around. That is how powerful the addiction has become.
So social media continues to evolve and change. It's fair to say that it's not going away anytime soon. Parents and educators, how can they help hone young people to use it the right way, not overuse it, and to make it a healthy option for them, a healthy outlet?
Well, a question I often get asked by parents is, how do I get my teen off of social media? And the answer is an unpopular one, you don't. You know, with my generation, we interacted and understood our world by hanging out at the malls and, you know, interacting in a completely different way. Social media is the world of adolescence. So it is unrealistic to expect them to no longer use it, even if it's hurting them. What I advise parents to do is to, instead of like blocking it, to which they're not going to be able to anyway. You know, there are many creative ways, fake usernames, et cetera, for teens to get on social media, and they will. But it's important to understand it, to talk to your teen about what they like about different platforms, to regularly check the friend list to make sure that these are friends that they actually know, because there are a lot of fake profiles, and just to teach them responsibility through their communication and interactions with a particular emphasis on the negative effects of cyberbullying and the incredible negative emotional impact that can carry. So it's more about dialogue and understanding and really checking your teen's privacy features to make sure that they're up to par.
As we continue on Sound Ideas, I'm Eric Stock with Dr. Susanna Flores, who is going to be presenting, one of the presenters, this coming Monday at the Behavioral Health Community Forum, joined also by Tricia Malott, the McLean County Behavioral Health Coordinating Council Supervisor. Tricia, can you touch on what kind of impact that you've seen here in McLean County locally with the use or sometimes overuse, misuse perhaps of a social media among young people?
I think it's important to note that this isn't a limited issue, and so it's not something that's just captured in research or in other countries, and I think it's important for parents to recognize that it is happening here at a local level. And as a clinician who has practiced in the community, I have seen parents or adolescents come into my office impacted by issues such as this. I have heard from colleagues and other parents who have taken certain steps to try to help protect their child, and I agree with Dr. Flores that so much of it is about dialogue and keeping lines of communication open so that there is that trust and that regular check-in between parents and kids.
And once again, going back to the health forum this coming Monday, there are two places where there will be sessions, first at Normal Theater in Uptown and the Bloomington Normal Marriott Hotel and Conference Center. If you could explain how that's going to work.
Absolutely. So our day starts at the Normal Theater, and we'll kick off with opening remarks, and that start to our day is for everyone. So we will all begin together at the Normal Theater. That's for adults and adolescents alike. And after our opening remarks from Chairman McIntyre, we will go into our keynote address by Dr. Flores. And from that point on, then our day splits a little bit, and our adolescents will stay in the normal theater for their sessions, and the adults will head over to the Marriott for their breakout sessions, and we have over 14 sessions for adults to choose from that day.
And you're referring to John McIntyre, chairman of the McLean County Board, who has been instrumental in the community health forum here in McLean County. You'd mentioned earlier mindfulness and relaxation techniques. Is that perhaps one antidote to the anxiety that many young people are dealing with from a social media standpoint?
I think it's one option. I would generally say I don't think the solution is one size fits all. And what may work for adolescent A is not going to be what works for adolescent B. But mindfulness and relaxation are definitely one of the ways to go. And we have Abby Lyons, who works for McLean County Unit 5 and is also part of, she developed a business called The Elephant Tree. And part of her focus is to help train teachers on their ability to use those skills in classrooms. And so she will be doing those sessions with the adolescents that day.
And so this forum is on Monday, a day off for students. Obviously, that was done intentionally on your part. Do you feel that you can bring out the kind of response from young people to come in on a day off school to do something educational like this?
Well, we certainly hope so. We definitely recognize that there is the barrier of perhaps as simple as getting out of bed and going somewhere on a day off. We also have some giveaways. And so one of the things that we are going to do is we've tried to break up their day. And so their day isn't just sitting in one spot and listening to a bunch of adults talk all day. Instead, they may have a 10-minute period of time where they can move around, and it's part of that mindful movement. And then they may have 20 minutes of listening to someone when we have peers coming in. But we're also doing kind of like a raffle giveaway almost at every break for the adolescents so that they can walk away with a prize and get free stuff. And they can bring their friends. I mean, so that's the other way to look at this is it could be a way for them to spend time with their friends and not home by themselves.
And Dr. Flores, as you make your way here to McLean County to talk to young people and educators and the like, how will you define a successful experience, a successful message in getting through to the young people here?
I think as long as they can get an awareness of steps that they can take to protect themselves and to respect others on social media, I will consider it a success, and I will give examples of how they can do that. You know, it's a matter of, you know, like the golden rule, treat others as you would want to be treated, and hopefully it would be a step towards positive change.
That story from GLT's Eric Stock. The behavioral health forum is free, though registration is recommended. There's a link at WGLT.org.
Did you hear about the recent boom in paleontologists inspired by a famous film?
The Jurassic Generation is 100% a thing.
Or what about the couple that proposed to each other simultaneously?
What are you doing?
I'm Ari Shapiro. The world is full of all kinds of news, and when you support NPR, you help us report the good, the sad, the strange, and the joyful.
Thanks for listening to GLT. Your support keeps us going, so contribute anytime at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from Heritage Health Therapy and Senior Care, exclusive providers of Restore Therapy. Restore Therapy, where your rehab and independence mean more. On the web at heritageofcare.com/restore. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. When Todd Hovenden opened Biagi's Italian restaurant in Bloomington in 1999, he had never run a restaurant before. Nearly two decades later, Biagi's has established as one of Bloomington Normal's most popular restaurants and now has 19 locations in 9 states. Now Hovenden is branching out, launching the company's first Mexican Tex-Mex restaurant that will open in the spring next door to what will be the new Biagi's location at the northeast corner of Empire Street, Airport Road in Bloomington. He sat down with GLT's Eric Stock.
We're very, very excited about this, and we'll be opening hopefully in middle of March, depending on winter weather. But we've been in Bloomington. Well, March 8th will be our 20th year here in Bloomington, and for a long time we've considered other concepts, and this is one that we felt had some opportunity here in town. We love Bloomington. We have other restaurants around the country because of the support that we've received in Bloomington over the years. So a little bit of it is just selfishness. My wife and I live here. Our corporate staff lives here, and we're looking for other opportunities to dine out, but we just believe in this market and believe that there's an opportunity for the kind of concept that we've envisioned our new restaurant to be.
And if you could explain what that concept will be.
You know, for a lot of people, I guess the easiest thing for me to say would be that it is Biagi's in nature, in the sense that it's Biagi's level of service, and we hope that, you know, Biagi's level of cuisine, in the sense that we're going to make everything from scratch. We have no walk-in freezers or anything. We have a nice big bar presence. We have a big patio coming to the restaurant, but it will be far more casual than Biagi's. And as an example, there is not even a sixth of the amount of millwork and wood floors in this concept. It's much more of a concept that you're going to feel far more comfortable bringing your kids to, or coming in after you've mowed the yard on a Tuesday night or gone to Little League practice on a Wednesday. So we really are trying to bring to the community a concept that everybody feels very comfortable in. And it's not the more planned out dining occasion that sometimes Biagi's can be for a lot of the community.
How much will you borrow from Biagi's name and legacy in this new restaurant? In other words, when people walk in, are they going to know that this is a Biagi's type restaurant? Because it sounds like the style and the motif is going to be very different.
It will be. And if somebody comes in and doesn't specifically ask, they won't know that this is a concept that was developed by Biagi's. It really is a standalone concept where we have different supporters of this concept. We have different chefs. We'll, of course, be handling everything from corporate here, but it's a concept in and of itself. And like I said, it really hopefully does fit a different niche in the market.
You talk about the style of it being different, but I guess the success of any restaurant boils down to the food and how good it is. How big of a jump is it in the restaurant business to go from Italian cuisine now to Mexican?
So that's a very good question. And clearly you can't just take somebody who has knowledge of Italian cuisine and have them develop your menu for a Mexican concept. But we are approaching this from very different angles, and we've been interviewing a lot of executive chefs from around the country, and we have an opportunity to bring in some folks who have a longstanding knowledge and base in the Mexican cuisine. And so that's our approach. It's not simply to take some of our chefs necessarily from Biagi's and ask them to start cooking Mexican cuisine. You know, a lot of us understand Mexican cuisine because of all of the restaurants that we go to here, or maybe we vacation in Mexico, but, you know, it's very regionalized in Mexico. And also there's a lot of depth of flavors that it's difficult for a lot of folks chefs to understand right from the beginning. It takes years and years of practice to master this cuisine, as simple as sometimes we think it is here in America.
You talked about how loyal you are to Bloomington Normal. It seems to be a community where people really like to eat out. Is that just our perception, or is that reality based on what you've seen?
I think it is reality. You know, there's a lot of community, especially when we get calls from real estate developers that they try to pitch us on, this community eats out more than any other community in America. But really, I feel like the folks in Bloomington here do that. It's a very social community, and that really is the basis of dining out for a lot of people. It's a social occasion as much as some place to just go and eat.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Eric Stock with Todd Holmenden, who is the founder and CEO of the Biagi's restaurant franchise. The place where you're going on the east side, of course, you'll be right next to your own Biagi's. There are several restaurants not too far from there, including Avanti's, another popular Italian restaurant in town. Can there be too much of a glut in one place, too much competition in one location in the community, or can a cluster of popular restaurants all help each other?
Definitely, I'm a fan of the latter in the sense that we're on a lot of lifestyle centers around the country. And one of the reasons we go to those lifestyle centers is not necessarily because of the retail that sits in the lifestyle center behind us, but because we want to go where it's new, it's well landscaped, it's secure, it's well lit. It's the place that people think of when they're kind of cycling through in their own mind, hey, should we go out to dinner tonight? And they start thinking whether it's up and down veterans or it's at a lifestyle center, or it's at a mall, or hopefully in this area, as you called it, a cluster out east on Route 9, that folks think, okay, we can go out that direction and we have all these different options.
Is it the intention to make this new Mexican Tex-Mex restaurant another Biagi's type in terms of expansion as you're now in 9 states with the Italian model?
Our focus right now is certainly on our first restaurant, and because we're building it from the ground up and it's a brand new concept for us, there's a lot of work that's going into everything from the design, the exterior design, the interior, every new plate and silverware and glass, where it has to be selected from scratch on these. We have to come up with the entire menu and the recipe. So we have a lot going on with this, but the intent is if there's opportunities out there for us to grow this concept the way that we've grown Biagi's, we're certainly prepared to do that.
Does it have a name?
We have another week or so of considering several names that we have on our list. So right now, it's not a definitive answer.
Well, there's always been talk behind Biagi's name and how that came to be. Can you explain that?
Sure. So I was actually at grad school at Northwestern University getting my MBA before I started Biagi's, and I was searching all over the place for a name for Biagi's. I actually had a map of Italy out on my floor going through every little village. I had the English-Italian dictionary I was going through. I was all the way to the S's trying to find a good name. I actually watched all the Godfather movies. I didn't watch the movies. I just watched the credits trying to find a name that I could use for Biagi's, and I was really coming up with nothing. And then one night I was sitting watching ESPN at about 2 in the morning because I'd been writing my business plan for Biagi's, and I had my son on my knee, and for some reason he was up at 1:30 or 2 o'clock in the morning. He was 1 year old at the time, maybe 2. And so we were watching ESPN, and they were on Moto Week, and they went to interview this supermoto racer. His name was Biagi, and I kind of perked up and I said, yeah, Biagi's, that's not too bad. And my son Max, as I said, was sitting on my knee, and when they went to interview this motorcycle racer, his name was Max Biagi, and so the light bulb kind of went off, and that's how we ended up with the name. And ironically, he's actually been to one of our restaurants now. They do a race here, a couple of different stops here in the United States each year, and Max Biagi actually has been to one of our restaurants in Eaton.
You tell them they named it after him.
They did.
So are you looking for some divine inspiration for the new restaurant to come up with a name for it?
Well, and I was just searching. I was getting a little nervous because I'd already written most of the business plan, and we were starting to raise some equity and talk to the banks and do some real estate deals, and I was still searching for a name. And so I was scrambling a little bit.
How important is it to a business plan and to a restaurant success, do you feel, or is it not that important?
It is important. More important, I believe, is the brand itself. So how you leverage everything from the name to the uniforms to the menu design, your website, your social media, all of that plays a far more important role in my mind collectively than just simply the name itself.
That's Biagi's CEO Todd Hovenden with GLT's Eric Stock. Biagi's plans to open its new location next fall. The current restaurant will remain open until then. The company's also moving its corporate offices to that location. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. There's not a lot of in-between on squirrels. People either think they're annoying rodents or think they're cute little critters and like to have them around. In this edition of our gardening show, Grow, GLT's Mike McCurdy and ISU's Patrick Murphy come clean with their affection for the numerous Central Illinois species of these nut lovers.
When you think of squirrels, you may first think of the fox squirrel, the usually reddish, bushy-tailed, frisky bird feeder visitor, but there are other species, and they depend on native trees. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice from our expert Patrick Murphy from Illinois State University's School of Biological Sciences, and he's the curator of the Fell Arboretum. Murph, thanks for stopping by.
You bet, Mike.
So before we get into the various species of squirrels, people can find in Central Illinois, and a related listener question. How did you come across this topic of squirrels and native trees?
Well, I think it's because people listen to our program, and Lauren Brown, who I'm going to talk about in his work, along with his son's work, Evan Brown, they've heard us talk about squirrels. They've heard us make little positive references. So he placed some research from a magazine called The Nutshells, Spring 2018 edition. And it has some interesting information about squirrels.
So it's their research.
It's their research.
And so what do we have in Central Illinois?
Well, what I found was very interesting is that there is plenty of evidence of the southern flying squirrel here in Central Illinois, right here in McLean County, and even here on Illinois State University's campus.
Oh, really? There are flying squirrels on the ISU campus.
That's right.
Interesting. So I have a friend who did some camping in West Central Illinois, and he was in a hammock, and through the night, he sensed something flying around, and he could hear it, and finally got his flashlight out, and he could see that they were flying squirrels. So he was astonished.
I think that's why a lot of people may be unaware of their presence, because they are nocturnal. They move around, they eat, they fill their food caches at night, and they typically avoid campfires. They typically avoid, your porch light or your yard lights and things like that, because it interferes with their nocturnal vision.
So we'll talk about flying squirrels a little bit more in a moment, but there are other squirrel species here.
We have the...
Besides the red fox squirrel that I mentioned.
There's a real common eastern fox squirrel. Some places the common name for that is the fox tail squirrel. We have the 13-line ground squirrel.
A chipmunk, basically, right?
And the chipmunk.
Oh.
So the 13-line ground squirrel is a different critter than the eastern chipmunk. So we have both. And one is cute with stripes, and the other one has some dots and no stripes. So they are a little bit different. And those three species, they eat their nuts where they find them, or they take them back to the nest where they live. And that's kind of the big revelation from this study, is that people, myself, Dr. Brown, his son, Dr. Brown, they've found the nut caches, which indicate the presence, because the nut cache is specific to the flying squirrel.
So these are different size squirrels. The flying squirrels aren't the same size as the red squirrels.
They're not, Mike. They're very small. Matter of fact, the black walnut, sometimes the walnut itself is bigger than the skull of the flying squirrel, which makes, again,
so
another
maybe
reason.
Maybe half the size of a fox squirrel.
Yes, much smaller, a little bit bigger than a ground squirrel. But I think that's what's one of the things that fascinates me personally about the squirrels is they manage to get nuts open that are hard for grown men to crack them open. You know, especially if you look at like a buckeye, it's got a horned hull on it. Walnuts are hard to get open, and in antiquity, people would drive cars over them to bust the shells to get to the meat on the inside. But the little squirrel burrows some round, smooth-edged holes in there, but he puts the nuts away, and he might put them away in a place different from where he stays.
So which of these squirrels has the most symbiotic relationship with native trees in the area?
Well, I think Lauren and Evan Brown's writing indicates that the squirrels themselves is one big category. They have a bigger impact on the nut trees in the forest than the insects do. And along those lines, bigger than the birds do, too.
So a negative or positive impact?
Well, it follows it, and it depends on your point of view. But a lot of times, the squirrels, the flying squirrels, as well as the other ones that are kind of, climbers and ground squirrels, they eat a lot more nuts than the trees lose from, say, insect infestation. Right. But the squirrel's activity can make the amount of nuts produced ebb and flow also. They have some influence on that.
So maybe there's not an answer to this question. Do squirrels help or hurt trees? Do they propagate saplings by burying nuts and forgetting about them?
They do. The trees in the forest are there partly because of the squirrels. Some of the nuts that are buried by the ground squirrels and the fox squirrels, they never find them, and then they turn into a tree later. A lot of the nuts, though, from the flying squirrel, they'll never turn into a tree because they're gnawing holes in the outside of the nut.
Or they've been cached somewhere where there's no soil contact.
That's the other part of it, yes.
So what kind of trees are we talking about? What do the squirrels like to eat in central Illinois?
In this area, the forest that Lauren Brown and Evan Brown examined had the predictable company of a lot of the nut-producing trees, like several varieties of acorn-producing oaks. So you got your black oaks, chinkapin oaks that are much sought after, along with your red oaks, white oak, the state tree, black oak. These all grow here in the Midwest. They grow right here in McLean County. But it also includes the pecans and hickories also, because they're producing a lot of nuts as well.
So let's get to our related question from Gretchen Monte. She's noticed what she calls an acorn deluge this season, and she's heard that oaks have a four-year cycle and that the squirrel population responds accordingly to the increase in food supply. What do you think? Is that it?
Yeah, I think there's a couple points of view on that. One point of view is kind of the biology and botany point of view, and that's the trees, red oak produces acorns over a two-year cycle. And they can have periods of weather where the tree is perceiving stress and they produce a bumper crop, if you will, of nuts that's above and beyond what they normally produce. This is also found with trees that are in domesticated orchards where the tree is starting to outgrow its usefulness. And there's some controlled injury made to the tree to kind of coax it into surviving by producing a lot of extra nuts. This is done in orchards as well for apples and all that great stuff that comes from orchards. When there are a lot of extra nuts, there's more foraging going on by the squirrels, and the squirrel population oftentimes increases after a great big crop of the nuts.
So we would see the squirrel population increase after that big increase in acorns, not at the same year.
Right. It would be close together, though, because it only takes about 6 months to make a new squirrel. Yeah.
So do you feed the squirrels, or do you work to prevent them from raiding your feeders?
Well, I practice keeping the trees away from the roof of my home, and in professional practice, I try to manage that, too, to keep the squirrels off of buildings. But other than that, I love them. I love seeing them out there, the movement, the color. It's just a living thing, and they're adorable. I do feed them. I feed them corn.
Yeah. So I feed them corn and peanuts, and frankly, that keeps them out of the feeder too.
Yeah.
The squirrels have to fight with the blue jays and the crows over the peanuts, but I enjoy feeding.
I enjoy feeding
the critters as well. If you have any questions about squirrels and native trees or anything in your yard or garden, you can submit them at wglt.org/grow. Next week, we'll talk about seasonal preparation for gardens and yards. Are we talking about vegetable and flower beds, Murph?
We're going to talk about everything that's outside. So if you're a pioneer farmer, if you're a gardener, if you're a vegetable organic grower, we've got some information for everyone to help you avoid some troubles in the spring.
That's Patrick Murphy. I'm Mike McCurdy. Send your gardening questions to wglt.org/grow.
You can find past episodes of Grow at our website, wglt.org. It's also where you can subscribe to the Grow podcast. We're in the last few days here of the GLT Fall Fun Drive, and it's a serious thing. We're asking you to step up and support the GLT and NPR programs that matter to you. But that doesn't mean we can't have a little bit of fun, too. This week, we challenged our newsroom anchors to what we called the Straight-Faced Newscast Challenge. Wanted to test them, see if they can get through three strange but actually true news stories without laughing. The whole video is on our Facebook page, but here's a taste of it.
Oh, off to a flying start.
From the GLT Newsroom, I'm Charlie Schlenker.
From the GLT Newsroom, I'm Mary Cullen.
From the GLT Newsroom, I'm Eric Starr.
From the GLT Newsroom, I'm Laura Kennedy.
A former meerkat expert at the London Zoo has been ordered to pay compensation to a monkey handler.
She attacked with a wine glass and a love spat over a llama keeper.
A judge said this morning that Caroline Westlake must pay around $1,200 to Kate Sanders for assaulting her in a dispute over colleague Adam Davies, who had dated both women.
Judge said Sanders suffered a nasty face injury in the fracas at a zoo Christmas party. The judge also sentenced the 30-year-old Westlake to 12 months community service for assault.
An Ohio town is mourning the death of its first female mayor, a border collie named Lucy Liu.
Bobby Lane Kaiser announced in a Facebook post that Lucy Liu, the dog who served as mayor of Rabbit Hash until 2016, died Monday at the age of 12.
Lucy Liu was the third dog mayor of Rabbit Hash, the first female mayor of the town, and the first mayor to not die in office.
She had promised more transparency in her 2008 inaugural speech. Lucy Liu's primary duties included attending charity events and serving as spokesdog for the local women's shelter. K9 ran for president in 2016 as a write-in candidate, but lost to Republican Donald Trump.
And a man with an unusual name was arrested last night for allegedly assaulting two police officers in Washington State. The man whose legal name is
Bizao Dudu.
Bizao Dudu Zippity Bop Bop Bop.
Bizao Dudu. Bippity bop bop bop.
Bizo doo-doo zitty bop. Bop bop.
Bizo doo-doo zo dippity boo bop.
He legally changed his name in 2011.
Find more local and state news at our website, WGLT.org. I'm Mary Cullen.
I'm Eric Stock.
I'm Charlie Schlenker.
I'm Laura Kennedy.
How'd you do?
I totally butchered that zo dippity boo bop, whatever.
I made it. I blew the name.
I failed. I failed dramatically.
In all seriousness, it's our fun drive, and we love to make you guys laugh, but we also love to give you the news.
Local support, including your contribution, makes up 50% of the budget here at GLT.
That's the money we use to pay for the broadcast, internet, and on-demand services that you use every day.
We can't do what we do for you without your help.
Please contribute now at WGLT.org.
You can watch the whole Straight Face Newscast Challenge on our Facebook page. Thanks to everyone who's already contributed during this GLT Fall Fun Drive. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Our website is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories today with help from Eric Stock and Mike McCurdy and intern Austin Gold, who put that newscast video together. WGLT.org is the first place to go to subscribe to the Sound Ideas podcast, too. You can also check it out at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and NPR One. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.